And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
As winter spreads across the land, change is in the wind. A reawakening to the value of the true American spirit is rekindling a spark of renewal. Some are turning to the great tradition, heading to the wilderness to find truth. Some would say to get closer to God. Today, we quest into the Quetico for a glimpse of the divine when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News, and now, Sydney Wildsmith.
With a series of tornadoes swirling across America, it's hard to acknowledge that it's mid-November. Will 2005 be remembered as the year of weather, or will it be just the beginning of a long trend? A few weeks ago, I visited the National Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C., and while visiting the Hall of the Dinosaurs, they had a wonderful display of the Ice Age. Now here's the amazing truth about that. The last great glaciation lasted for about a million years. During that time, the entire area of Canada was under a solid sheet of ice that could be a mile or more in depth. Then, somewhat suddenly, the weather changed, and the Ice Age ended in a massive melting. The Mississippi River was one of the major melt channels for that time. And that was a mere 10,000 years ago. Weather, when it changes, can bring about very sudden changes. If this year is any indication, we'd have to believe change is coming. Most scientists agree and even warn and predict changes in the weather. But in all honesty, they most likely would not have predicted 3 years ago that the changes would happen this fast. So we'll just have to wait until next year, at this time, to see if a pattern is developing. Meanwhile, we've got a lot to talk about on today's show. If you're a regular listener, you may know that I'm prepared to go where the spirit leads, and that's just where we're heading today, as we tend towards the North Country, Minnesota and Wisconsin, to be precise. We begin the show as we go in-depth exploring the wilderness, specifically the Boundary Waters area, and talk with a member of a group who headed into the great wilderness on a quest for spiritual discovery. It's a journey of the soul that so many of you know about, sense, and experience. Today, we explore ways to interpret, speak about, and experience it. It's a great day of inner discovery. Then, in our third segment, we stay in the North Country as we visit this week's National Park of the Week, the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, which offers a great diversity of experiences not readily available in many parks, state or national. So after the news, we do a Quetico quest and beyond. So first, the news. Indiana's most deadly tornado in 30 years ripped through neighborhoods south and southeast of Evansville, killing at least 22 people and wrecking approximately 400 homes. Further damage was observed along the tornado's 30-mile-long path. A large swatch of China's breadbasket may soon be covered in sand due to a rapidly expanding desert, state media reported. The greatest threat is to the Chengdu Plain in Sichuan Province, a source of grain since ancient times. Spreading desertification about 190 miles from the Sichuan's key growing areas threatens to engulf vast tracts of grain fields with sand. The upwind grasslands were vast green pastures until a few decades ago when cows and goats there suddenly started to multiply in numbers and overgraze. They've come a long way. At the turn of the century, only 20 bison survived in Yellowstone National Park. Today, the population is estimated at 4,900. Tuesday, the 15-year ban on bison hunting was lifted in Montana, and the first bison shot was by a 17-year-old hunter just outside the northern boundary of the park. The bison shooting was filmed for use in bison hunting advocacy films. A bit of tape was used up, as it took between a half an hour and 45 minutes for the bison to finally die. It also took four additional bullets to finish the job. A federal judge temporarily barred a logging project on Monday that would have included a small section of California's giant Sequoia National Monument. The plan in question would thin trees across 1,322 acres, of which one quarter were within the giant Sequoia National Monument. The plan, which was proposed as a means to lessen fire dangers, follows on a separate decision Monday from a larger legal battle in which California and environmental groups are suing the Bush administration over a plan to allow timber harvesting in the preserve. Say, you'll never guess who's in the running for Time Magazine's Person of the Year for good old 2005. She's big, she's beautiful, and people go out of their way to get glimpses of her from literally every corner of the earth. Perhaps you've guessed, it's Mother Nature. But such recognition does not necessarily mean she's honored as being great and good. After all, Adolf Hitler was Time's Person of the Year in 1938, Joseph Stalin in 1939, and Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979. The selections have been made, but the results are secret. You'll just have to wait until December 18th to find out. And that's the news. And just a reminder that the Wildside News archives are undergoing a temporary upgrading, which means that almost all shows from last year cannot be listened to. However, this is being updated, and we will redo the shows, starting with the most recent or our most listened to, and continuing on until, once again, all of the great shows on your Voice of the Earth are back to normal. And please keep me informed of things happening in your neck of the woods, or prairie, or seashore. Send your emails to wildsidenews@cox.net, COX.NET. So now, let's go in depth as we look at the spiritual nature of wilderness.
There's a lot of talk these days about spirituality in nature, and it comes from many different perspectives. A lot of people refer to it sort of casually and generally, that the nature has a spiritual quality in nature. And some people take it more literally and seriously. Even within the mainstream American religious tenets of Christianity and Judaism, there certainly is a lot of reference to the spirituality of nature. But joining us right now is Greg Fitzhausen from Ithaca, New York. He's working on his doctoral thesis at Cornell. Greg, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks a lot, Sydney.
You have a particular fascination with the relationship of North American religion to spirituality. Why don't you give us a little background on sort of what your quest is, and let's start with that.
Yeah, well, I grew up in a family where conservation was important, and one of the reasons it was important was because it was an outgrowth of Christian faith. I had a grandfather who retired off the farm in Iowa and went into soil conservation, and he had all kinds of favorite sayings about how we were to care for the earth and be good stewards of what God has given us. And that sort of left an impression on me that there could be a really healthy integration of a faith perspective with a concern for conservation. And so I've sort of carried that with me through a career in environmental education. And the more I worked in environmental education, I discovered that if you could bring in someone's religious perspective, their spirituality, and sort of some of their ultimate beliefs into the realm of thinking about how we relate to the natural world, that can really deepen and strengthen a person's sense of responsibility to the creation. So my interest has gone in a lot of different directions, but I particularly have focused on how churches and synagogues and other faith communities have engaged environmental issues through advocacy and education, and then also how a number of Christian and Jewish programs have actually done outdoor wilderness programs designed to teach environmental ethics.
So in the process of exploring and researching this, we're going to talk about about a personal experience that you've had with the group opening the Book of Nature and experiencing the boundary waters. But kind of as an overview, since you are a serious researcher, what are you finding as sort of a state of the art in terms of this movement of the spiritual communities into acknowledging the spiritual side of nature?
Yeah, well, it's really diverse. It's as diverse as there are spiritual expressions and diverse as there are denominations, even within the Christian church. And to watch the growth of this over the last 30 years, I think it was true 20 and 30 years ago that there were mainly individual theologians, individual pastors, individual congregations here and there, where there might have been a few people getting involved in environmental concerns from the perspective of their faith, but they tended not to realize that anyone else was doing it. And when I went to college in the late 1980s and studied ecology, I got the impression from my professors that, by and large, the Christian tradition, at least, was sort of a bad thing for the environment. But the 1980s was then the time when a lot of the denominations of the church began to sort of make connections with one another. And a huge literature of eco-theology, let's call it, started to blossom at that point and has just continued to increase ever since that time. So you can find any number of approaches out there. You can find lots of examples as well of different forms of advocacy, whether that's through concerns for environmental justice or whether that's through concerns for stewardship education, for getting people to take seriously their responsibility of being stewards of God's creation, we might say, or whether that's through what might be called creation spirituality, which is more of a spiritual approach, more focused on making connections as spiritual beings with the natural world that reinforce our sense of kinship and care for God's creation. So there really are a whole range of expressions of this. In the world of environmental education and wilderness programs, there are also a number of different programs that have tried different things over a couple of decades now, and I think there are some really nice models for how wilderness experience with a group of people together in a particular place can really bring together a lot of the themes that, say, Christian tradition offers to the appreciation of nature. And the Opening the Book of Nature program is a great example of that. Part of the reason I got involved with this particular trip to the Boundary Waters was because I'd become aware of the Opening the Book of Nature program through my research and thought, now that is a program that has really done a nice job of drawing from the history of Christian tradition and from an understanding of spiritual development based on the tradition, and connecting that with the kinds of experiences people tend to have in the wilderness, the kinds of experiences that tend to be described as spiritual. You know, in a sense, the Opening the Book of Nature is a good example of sort of the state of the art, but there are also other approaches and other forms that we could probably spend weeks talking about.
One of the challenges right now is the fact that this aspect of specifically Christianity and the environment has been so politicized that it's really clouding the issue in many respects and confusing it. And I think perhaps that's one of the reasons that you personally are trying. I'm not saying that it's necessarily politically motivated, but just that if we're really to create some sort of sense of stewardship for the earth, that we're going to have to address this relationship of the faith communities to the environment, and you're really researching that realm.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think in some ways it's been unfortunate that there's been so much animosity between environmental philosophies and some Christian philosophies, I guess you might say. It seems that environmental ethics has often been taught that there are good ways to think about the environment, such as biocentrism, and then there are bad ways to think about the environment, such as something more traditionally religious, something more anthropocentric. And there's some value to contrasting those kinds of views, but what's become increasingly clear is that from a more properly theocentric perspective, or even an anthropocentric perspective, there are some really strong and great values that can be brought out, things that resonate well with large and powerful religious communities and that allow people to embrace environmental values from within their own worldview. without having to convert all of their ways of thinking to something new, that in fact, and this is a hope for me for religious environmental education, is that we can begin to realize that within our predominant religious traditions, there are wonderful insights that can be rediscovered, that can be really powerful contributors and complements to environmental efforts in this country especially, but even around the world.
What brings us to this moment is a recent draft of a statement called A Christian Reflection on the Spiritual Values of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. What we're going to talk about now is really an approach that is being somewhat investigated and formulated, whereby by literally going into the wilderness, which certainly has a lot of spiritual historical relevance, by in the process of literally going into the wilderness, it can lead to a better and deeper sense of the spiritual connection. Why don't you explain what this adventure was about and give us some of the details on how it developed, and then we'll get into as well what you learned.
Yeah, great. Well, I think originally the Friends of the Boundary Waters invited the Opening Book of Nature program to address that area, to come to that area and try to state and express some of the spiritual values of the area, because there have been a number of other efforts around the country where we've come together to do that very thing, and it's had some influence. So because the Boundary Waters is one of those most cherished protected areas in our country and in the Quetico in Canada, and it's also one of the areas that's in the highest demand, there continues to be a concern that this area be protected and that the areas that lie outside it continue to be protected. And so that concern is very present of meeting the need that we have to continue to protect an area like that. So this seemed like a good place to come and do a spiritual exploration where we could particularly think about the values of a place like the Boundary Waters and what it offers to us spiritually, and what sort of ethical ideas emerge from our time there.
So also, for people who don't know, let's give a sense of what the Boundary Waters is, because when you immerse yourself in the Boundary Waters, you're going to a very special place.
One of the reasons I wanted to be a part of this trip was I've just been on two previous trips to the area, and both of them have been incredibly important to me just as a person in my own development. One trip with my family and then one trip with friends after college, and there's something about the solitude and the quietness of this vast area, large enough to contain, oh, I don't even know the number of lakes that are in the Boundary Waters and the rivers that through there, but large enough area to have packs of wolves, to sustain all manner of wildlife and fish, and offers such an incredible opportunity for recreational experiences, for contemplative experiences. There's a quietness there that I don't know if I've ever experienced it quite the same way anywhere else. One of the things I remember from this recent trip is we did an exercise where we spent some time drawing. And I'm not that much of an artist, but I was fascinated just watching the water sort of flow by and move on the surface. And I was foolish enough to try to draw that. I don't know if I should have even attempted it, but there's something about just the light and the dark, the wind and the waves, the sound of the water lapping on the shore. These are all things that are characteristic of this area, and that just have the effect of relaxing, of quieting the mind, of bringing us back to our center. And that's something that I cherish about that area and that I definitely experienced again on this trip.
Another aspect of the Boundary Waters is the fact that when you enter it, it literally opens up into Canada.
Yeah.
And you go into an area where you have to portage from lake to lake, and then you can paddle for hours and days and portage some more and keep going. And you could literally find yourself in the lost, and no one would know where you are, and there's every chance in the world that no one would ever try to rescue you, because the chances of finding you would be astronomically difficult.
That's right. You know, in fact, the second trip I took there, we went up into the Quetico, And the course, the route we chose to take, it turned out, nobody had told us this, but it turned out that the portage trails that we saw on the map and thought would look good to follow had been clogged up by a tornado some 15 years earlier. And what looked like it would take about an afternoon to cover on the map ended up taking us two full days. And we ended up in some interior lake where all of the campsites were overgrown with blueberries, actually. And we had this sense of being out where nobody had been for more than a decade. And that memory is etched in my mind as something that I don't know where else I could encounter that kind of a feeling.
I can recall also being on a lake in a canoe that you're only, well, now we have GPS, but prior to GPS, it was you and a map. And if you found yourself believing that you were in a particular lake and trying to orient that way, and then to your horror discover that that's not where you were, you really didn't know how to figure out where you were.
It's unsettling.
Yes, to say the least. And therefore, you find yourself going, how do I get out of this? And it's very personal. So it gives an opportunity for people to really put themselves up against the universe in a very personal way.
That's right.
So let's go on now. You decided to enter this realm with some friends. Let's talk about what your effort was on this quest.
Yeah, well, again, this quest, we were charged with having some time in the Boundary Waters, but also making a special effort to talk together, to reflect on our experiences, and to try as best we could to express some of the values that were present there. To express from our perspective of faith why this was important to our spiritual development, to our life of faith, what this had to do with our understanding of the protection of wilderness and the value of wilderness. And so we spent a couple of days in a base camp, kind of orienting and doing some preliminary exercises, and then we spent 6 days paddling and portaging and then on the far end, we had another day and a half to reflect and begin drafting our statement. And so what that meant was, in addition to the typical trip in the wilderness with a group of voyagers, we had set aside specific times for various spiritual exercises and also times to talk and discuss and begin drafting and forming some of our ideas. So it was a challenging trip on a lot of levels. It had all the sort of the joys and the uncertainties in some ways of wilderness travel, but we also had a focus of just trying to discern what it was that we were experiencing that could be expressed in a spiritual way. And this, you know, I think one of the things that helped us all appreciate is how wilderness experience actually has been formative for our own faith tradition. I mean, if you think about the formative event for the people of Israel in the, you know, the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, is the desert wandering in the wilderness. You know, God forms the nation of Israel as they wander in the wilderness, and they become the people of Israel through their wilderness experiences, where they learn that they couldn't store up more food than they needed. God provided for them. You know, that was sort of manna from heaven, and if they tried to gather too much, it would go bad, and it wouldn't do them any good. And I think that there's something then about the message of what it means to be a human being that can be learned very well in the wilderness, that you can't take more than you need. It forces you back to the essentials. It helps you clarify what's really important and what's really not. And there are enough common themes along those lines within our scriptural traditions that we can really focus on those and reflect on those and kind of go deeper into all of this. The other classic example of that, we cite a passage from the Gospel of Luke about Jesus withdrawing into the wilderness and praying. And it happens, if you look through the Gospels of the Christian New Testament, there just are a lot of times, mostly before a lot of the major miracles that Jesus performs or other big events, Jesus or he and his disciples will withdraw to the quiet places. They will withdraw to the wilderness over and over again. There's this modeling of going off to a remote place for rejuvenation, for fellowship, for clarification, for prayer, to be prepared for the rest of our work in the world. And so in a lot of ways, that's the kind of thing I think we felt that we were doing as well, was withdrawing to the wilderness to better understand and to prepare ourselves for our work in the world. And there's a lot of powerful insights to be gained there, and more than just taking a break. I think there's a lot of inspiration that comes from that.
Obviously, a lot of people who go to the Boundary Waters may go in just for recreation and almost invariably come out feeling somehow that they've had a very special experience.
Yeah.
Just by the nature of the experience. But you actually approach this from a little bit different perspective, and that is that you have intention in terms of trying to discern or to experience the spiritual connection. Tell us how you think that perhaps makes a difference.
Well, it makes a difference in introducing a whole new set of possibilities. It also could work in the opposite direction. I think if you go in, it's sort of a spiritual lesson itself. If you go in with too much intention or you want something too bad, you often keep yourself from experiencing it. So one of the challenges of going in with an intention like this is not therefore going in with some sort of agenda, but rather going in with some sort of knowledge of what's possible and being open to those possibilities. And I think that better expresses kind of what we were going into, was an expectation that we, if we were open to learning, that we could delve into some of the spiritual depths of our experience in the wilderness. But the other thing, I guess, that this offers the opportunity for then with this intention, intention is coupled with a certain amount of planning, with a certain amount of understanding of various disciplines and exercises that can lead to a greater appreciation of the wilderness experience. And so we would have themes on different days, themes like Thanksgiving or wonder or the love of creation, and those would be themes that would help us sort of open up to and understand some of the spiritual value of our time there. And I think those became sort of focus points. It isn't a matter of, I don't think it's a matter of imposing a structure on a wilderness experience as much as it is a matter of, over time, coming to recognize that certain spiritual exercises and disciplines have great resonance with the kind of experiences we have in the wilderness. And if we can match our experiences in the wilderness with the kinds of spiritual exercise and reflection that has been fruitful within our tradition, we can start to build stronger links between our tradition and an appreciation of the wilderness.
When we return, we continue our journey as we explore the spiritual nature of the Boundary Waters Wilderness as your voice of the earth circles the globe on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Take a walk on the wild side and just keep walking till you come to the place where the wilderness begins. Then take a giant leap of faith into the wild lands and free fall your way into the Great Spirit. And when you return, your pockets are filled with the golden nectar of divine revelation. When we continue our quest of the spiritual values of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness, it's here on the Wild Side News. A small group of men entered the Boundary Waters Canoe Area in northern Minnesota, one of the world's great wilderness places, as they opened the Book of Nature to explore the spiritual values of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area. One of those men was Greg Fitzhausen. Our discussion continues.
Let's start to explore what it is that you and your fellow voyageurs discovered in this quest.
I guess I could use examples from the statement that we've drafted. We sort of are trying to reach towards some principles of a theology of wilderness, you might say. And the first one that we list is that the wilderness is a place to learn about God. Wilderness is a place that nurtures spiritual formation. And some of this is based on our reading of a passage in the book of Romans that says, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that we are without excuse. And what that suggests is that God's invisible qualities, the things we always try to put our understanding, wrap our understanding around God, but if there's one thing that's not ultimately knowable or graspable and keeps us coming back for more, it's the nature of God, it's the nature of existence. And yet, the qualities of God are able to be perceived in what has been created. And this is a real touch point for a group like ours to realize that all of creation can teach us something about God and can deepen our own sense of our faith. Now, similar sort of to a comment that was made by St. Thomas Aquinas, and he said something along, I paraphrase, he said something along the lines of that no one thing in creation could fully reflect the glory of God, and that is why we have the diversity of all things in creation, that they might better reflect the glory of God. And this is some of the kind of appreciation I think that we're striving for, is to understand that we can learn of the way things are through what God has created. We can learn of who God is through what God has created, and it can lead us to praise God even more. So that's one of the learnings that we drew out of this time.
Let me ask you something, too, on a very personal note. What was the experience of experiencing or coming to know? What did you sense? How did you sense these connections?
Interesting. It's a little bit like trying to explain how you come to know some of the most important but yet intangible things in your life. It's a little bit like love. It's a little bit like those deepest things we believe, which are hard to, we can't control them in some ways, and yet we believe them and we benefit from them. I guess if I had to explain how I came to know or feel that, I could describe a couple of the instances, a couple of the exercises. One of the exercises we did was to take a time of silence, silent meditation. And part of an exercise like that is opening up to just the experience of being. Our lives, especially in this culture, are so saturated with doing, 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 achieving, making, and being constantly busy and fixing things and all that. But just to stop and to be, especially in a place like the Boundary Waters that is so quiet and the solitude is of such an excellent sort, this opens up a time of feeling, of knowing, in a sort of a whole being kind of way, the presence of God. Just being surrounded by God's presence and by the sense that my place in this grand creation, although I am just a tiny, tiny little speck, I mean, the wilderness can make you quite humble in realizing how small you are, but I think there's also this sense of being embraced, nonetheless, in the warmth of God's love that in some way is communicated through a perception of God's presence. But I don't know, it's the kind of thing that's there all the time, but in the busy, everyday humdrum of our lives, we often don't stop to take notice of it. So I think that's one of those times where some of the exercises that we intentionally did in the wilderness helped us to experience and encounter the blessings of a spiritual experience that resonates with our faith.
I'm going to push this even a little farther, because I think this is critical. You mentioned two words, feeling and knowing. Those are two ways of getting a message. When we feel something, I'm curious, this is very personal, but how would you, or where would you feel that, and how would you sense that that was important? And then the second dynamic is, at the same time, knowing, how would that information come into your cognizance? So let's start with the feeling. Where or how would you feel that?
These are big questions, and I'm not sure I can really give an adequate answer. But for myself personally,
that I think is how it happens.
Yeah, exactly. We are earthy, and what part of what I feel and know has to do with my senses, with my physical senses, with the slowing down of my breathing, with the calm that enters into me, with the relaxation of my muscles, with attuning the rhythm of my breathing to the sound of the waves or of the wind, and starting to be aware of things other than myself. Somehow enriches my own being. I'm going to resort to a sense of what I think is going on. This is my belief about what's going on. I think the very nature of reality is relational. And so what we feel has to do with what we're relating to. And so often we're so wrapped up in our own agenda, in our own ego, and what we want for ourselves, that we don't really pay attention to other things. And so in a space like that, when you actually start to stop and feel the rest of creation, stop and feel the other people you're with and what's really going on for them, it opens up a whole new dimension of our own selves, of our more real selves, ourselves in relation to all the rest of the world. So I think that part of that feeling is very directly just the literal feeling of relationship to other things, physically, and memories that are in my mind of what we paddled through yesterday, or the conversation I had with David in the canoe, or whatever it might be. These are all things that add to this of what I'm feeling. As for how that translates into knowledge, we're a little bit handicapped, I think, in this culture. Perhaps ever since the Enlightenment, there's been this notion that the rational mind is the seat of true human being, and that our sort of cognitive rationality, if you will, is all that matters. And of course, that's a very, very important kind of knowing and a kind of knowledge. It's the basis of the natural sciences. And so the things that we can know and can experiment with and can deduce are very important and very powerful, and have led to all kinds of discoveries and important understandings of the way the world works. But that's not the only way that we know. I think there really is something that there is a sort of an embodied kind of knowing that is available to human beings, that is the integration of our feelings and our emotions with our rational cognitions. And for instance, for the Greek Orthodox Christian tradition, this is what theology really is. Some will say that in the last 100 years, the study of theology has sort of lost its way because it's just a bunch of words of people talking about God and talking about what God's supposed to mean. Whereas real theology, say according to the Greek Orthodox, would be what we can say of God based on our common experience of God. And what that means is that we've had intuitions. What that means is that we've had mystical experiences. And these may not be the kinds of things that we can repeat or control or duplicate with some kind of scientific precision so that we could prove it in a rational, cognitive kind of way. But these are the things that we know, we seem to know and trust more deeply than anything else. And it's those things that we connect with, the cognitive things we know, the things we see, the things we can repeat. And I think it's in the integration of what we know intuitively, mystically, with those things that we know more rationally, that we have a more full kind of human knowing. And a wilderness setting is an ideal place to help generate that. Kathleen Norris has written a great book about her time in a Benedictine monastery, and she talks about Gregorian chant and how that neurologists have discovered that the kind of pace every 2 to 4 seconds of a mantra or of a chant similar to the sound of waves lapping on the ocean shore, has an effect in the human brain of connecting our right and left hemispheres a little bit better, of helping them integrate. And I think that there may be some connection here. This kind of peace that we find and this sense of greater knowing things may in part come from getting into those rhythms, the rhythms of nature, and in our case, even the rhythms of our spiritual disciplines that help integrate our right and left hemispheres, that help integrate our mystical intuitive side with our rational side, and yield a fuller kind of full being knowing. And we can speak of it. We can all talk about these incredible experiences we've had in the wilderness, and we all, you know, you and I could sit around and nod, and I know what you're talking about, and you know what I'm talking about. Yet that doesn't mean that we can then write it all down in some kind of formula and claim to control it, and here's how it all works, and we just have to apply this scientific approach to it. There's still something mysterious about it. There's still something in some way transcendent about it, which is what makes it so valuable to us in the first place.
I think we're really making some progress here. It's fun to be able to talk about these things. It feels good.
Yeah.
From my perspective, the way I would interpret this is that the languaging is that we go to the wilderness to experience or find God. And what you've talked about is this process of slowing down and really opening up your senses. And what I find interesting from an intellectual perspective, but also I've also experienced this, is the concept that as we do that, then there is this thing about attunement and harmony.
Mm-hmm.
And it, literally in music, for example, there are literal resonances that are based on mathematics. And if we are able to, if you get two strings on a guitar and you pluck them, if they're in harmony with each other, they will start to resonate together. Just the energy will transfer. So this process of slowing down and beginning to listen and starting to try to literally attune yourself to the wilderness, if we see the wilderness as an expression of the divine, then what we begin to do is to resonate with that divinity and therefore become one with, and it's my way of interpreting what I experience.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then as one does that and begins to resonate with this sense of this literal power of divinity, then one can move that into the mind, and there becomes an inner harmony, and that actually is sort of an expression of inner peace, which is a way to interpret God or the divine. Let's go on as well to some of the other
parts of our statement. Yeah.
Correct, yes. Uh-huh.
Well, one of the other points we said was that wilderness cultivates community and friendship. And that has in part to do with the challenges of a wilderness area. We're not able to bring all our modern conveniences with us, thankfully. And we learn to be more frugal, and life is more simple, and things are more essential. And one of the things that was true on this trip that I've noticed over time as well is that you really start to see, you feel more viscerally your need for other people, for what they have to contribute. Your well-being depends more immediately on your cooperation with the other members of your group, and it also depends more immediately on the quality of your environment. You know, harsh weather is a much larger concern. Questions of getting lost and where are we matter. And so we have to pay closer attention to what's really going on, to what life really is in some ways when we're in that kind of space. And so cooperation and community, born of necessity, begin to create for us bonds that take us deeper into the experience. Like on this trip, for instance, one evening a cook pot got kicked over, and we lost one of our dinners, which presented a problem because we packed very efficiently for our food. And that meant that, well, we did have a couple fishing poles with us, and so we needed to catch some fish to have dinner the next night. And there was something about that, you know, people working together on that so that we'd have a good dinner. You know, I suppose we could have also fasted and gone for another kind of a spiritual experience. But there was something of the community coming together and responding to a need, and overcoming that challenge together that really is empowering in a lot of ways. And I think this immediacy of being aware of our surroundings and of checking in with one another's well-being is part of this need for being more open to that. And I think that's another one of those kinds of things that can then be linked to some of the insights from our faith tradition. If you think about the Genesis creation stories, where God, in the first chapter of Genesis, God creates each of these things, light and dark, and the plants and the animals, and when God creates and God looks and sees that it's good, each thing is seen to be good, and God charges the different creatures to be fruitful and multiply. Not just humans are charged to be fruitful and multiply, but so too are the other creatures. You think about those kinds of things, and it reinforces for us that part of our task is to encourage the kind of planetary health where all of God's creatures can be fruitful and multiply as God commanded them. I think something like that makes more sense. It's easier to be aware of that, sort of both viscerally, experientially, why that sort of thing is important when you're in the wilderness, where your well-being really does more directly seem to be linked to this interdependence with other people and with the natural world. So that would be another sort of insight that came out of our time and of our community experience.
It's kind of interesting, too, in the sense that ego begins to disappear in the wilderness.
Yeah.
For example, if you have to go out and fish, in a more sort of traditional fishing experience, there's a lot of ego. Well, you got the big fish.
Yeah.
In this particular case, if someone happens to catch the big fish, you're very thankful.
Yeah, that's right.
Because it feeds more people more effectively, and you feel better. So
yeah.
We can, instead of seeing that as a one-upsmanship, going on, it is a sense of, thank God he caught that fish.
Yeah, well, there's a real sense of gratitude that arises out of that. And in fact, in this particular case, it really was true. Our guide went out in a canoe, and he was trolling a lure, and he caught a relatively small bass. And when he saw it as it came up to the boat, he thought, well, that's a pretty small fish. And then suddenly a much larger northern pike grabbed that bass, and suddenly he had a pretty good-sized fish on the line.
Oh, my gosh, that's a great story.
He was able to net both of them in the end. And just as he netted the northern pike, he spit the bass out, so it was just in time. And it was, you get this sense of, holy, there was nothing I could have done. You couldn't repeat that. I can't make that happen every time. That's extraordinary. And there's a little bit of a sense of divine provision there.
Wow.
He came back with this fish that was large enough to feed us.
That's a great story.
Yeah, so I think that, and that raises another one of our other themes has to do with wilderness being God's gift. A gift is something, what's the appropriate response to a gift? Well, it's gratitude. And if we are thankful for what we have, and we value what we have, then we may be more likely to protect what we have, to cherish what we have. And there's the priest at my wife's parents' church has picked this up out of a sermon he gave one time, and he was talking about gratitude, and what he said was that gratitude turns what we have into enough. Gratitude turns what we have into enough. And I thought that is a truism that we experience out there. When we stop to give thanks for those things that we have, we realize that we have everything we need right here, right now, and more. And that's a powerful and important, and could be a very valuable lesson for particularly our culture. When we have so much, or affluence may be one of our problems, we don't seem to know where enough lies. Yet if we have a greater sense of gratitude, if we can give thanks for what we have, maybe that reduces that, whatever that is, that compulsive consumption that we have that we always seem to want more. I think that sense of gratitude was a real gift from our time in the wilderness. And I think if you can transfer that to your sense of human gratitude for the gift of creation, for life itself, that's one of the most powerful overall things that maybe our group or groups like ours will take out of a wilderness experience. One little example, Fred, who was leading the trip, took the time towards the end of it to pick up some particular small rocks, sort of palm-sized rocks. And he did that because I have a 13-month-old son who I couldn't help but talk about while we were on the trip. And Fred decided that my son Eli needed some good rocks from the boundary water that he could check out and play with. And so I came back with a small bag of rocks that Fred had chosen for my son. And now, on the one hand, those rocks are wonderful in and of themselves. I cherish those rocks because they're a part of the boundary waters. They remind me of that experience, and they're fascinating anyway. And my son loves rocks. I mean, we can hardly keep him out of the gravel driveway. He's going to be some kind of a geologist or a rock hound someday. But so those rocks are special in and of themselves. But the fact that they're a gift, the fact that Fred picked each one of those by hand to give to my son, makes them something more. They're not just wonderful rocks that are already a symbol of good things. They are a gift from Fred that adds special meaning to them, that makes them something that I'll cherish even more. And I think that that's sort of like the spiritual reality that we're encountering in a place like the Boundary Waters, that the creation and life itself is God's gift. And that's a gift that adds something intangible yet powerfully real to our care for creation.
This is, I was actually really smiling as you said that, because I think this is fascinating to think about, that these rocks that you have now, when you talk about them with your son, have special meaning, special added value, and yet it is, after all, just a rock.
Yeah.
And then you could have another rock from your backyard, and that's a different rock. But these rocks are special. So what it is that those rocks bring, I think, is part of the discovery of the spiritual nature. What is that? I don't know. We have an answer to that, but that's worthy of investigation. What is it that you attach to that rock that then reaches deep and brings on special meaning? And how much you apply, let's kind of...
Yeah.
Investigate that. What is it about the wilderness? There's lots of wild lands. There's a lot, you know, open forests and, my gosh, public lands and things. But let's talk about what you feel, because you are very specifically talking about the wilderness. Let's talk about that special meaning that wilderness brings, that is perhaps a little different than the other lands.
That's a great thing to add. I think before that, though, I should even be clear that in some sense we're all in trouble if the only place where we can get a real special sense of the natural world is in the wilderness. I mean, my son loves playing with rocks in the driveway. He is fascinated by the little cherries on the tree outside, our ornamental cherries that he loves to pull off. The flowers right here at our door stoop are an amazing world of nature to him, and I think that fostering that kind of appreciation in the everyday in our own backyards is critical to our formation as human beings. But yeah, there is this thing about the wilderness. Why did the prophets go to the wilderness? Why did Jesus and his disciples go to the wilderness? Why were the people of Israel formed in the wilderness? It's true in other religious traditions, enlightenment, the Buddha sitting under a tree, right? Or these kinds of metaphors that come out of wilderness experience seem to be perennially important, no matter what your religious perspective is or your philosophy. And I think that's in part because of something about the purity of the wilderness. In the wilderness where humans have had very little presence, very little impact, we see life and creation just as it is, without being confused by what we try to make it or what we might form it into. It's just the purest gift you could imagine. It's just the way it is. It's what's been given to us. We did not make this. It couldn't be anything other than a gift. And I think, that dimension of the wilderness may underlie what makes it such a powerful place. That's beyond just the fact that the wilderness is almost always spectacularly beautiful. I think that goes without saying that one of the reasons we preserve these places is because of their inspirational character, of their beauty. And beauty, if you followed Iris Murdoch at all, that she had this idea of the beginning of the ethical life is an unselfing. Rather than being preoccupied in our own illusions and all the things we wrap ourselves up in, but rather to be unselfed. And one of the beginning places for that to happen is by an encounter with beauty, an encounter with nature, or an encounter with love. These are the places where we become unselfed. And if we can become unselfed like that, because of the beauty of nature or of other people or of our intuition of God, then suddenly we have a much better vision of what's really going on in life. We are not the center of the world. We are not even nearly as important as we think. And yet, we are in relationship to all these other things. We are loved, and we are a part of this beautiful, beautiful thing. And that, for Iris Murdoch, was the starting point of the ethical life. And I think that helps explain some of the power of this and some of the potential of this, is that this, for us, can refine us as human beings. It can lead us to better living. And this is something that, you know, has to do with why we have national parks in the first place. There were a number of reasons why the original legislation passed in order to establish some of our early national parks. But one of the important elements that Frederick Law Olmsted would have talked about is that these spectacularly beautiful and scenic places have the capacity to give us an opportunity for contemplative recreation, to inspire, to pull us out of ourselves. And that has a refining quality. And for any nation who is going to be busy about the business of just living and getting by, that refining quality of the wilderness is something worth preserving and protecting and cherishing particularly. There may be other things that we could do in that area. I mean, we can play tennis right next to Bridal Veil Falls in Yosemite Valley, but what a silly place to play tennis. You can play tennis anywhere. There are a few places, however, though, where you can be so inspired by the beauty of some of these areas. And that, I think, is the special thing that wilderness areas offer us, is that particular opportunity for that sort of inspiration that you're not going to gain from my front yard.
I thought it was just interesting that you brought up the fact that we must not devalue what is in the yard, and quite honestly, the rocks in the yard. You were talking about your son, and that to me is where I think there's the loop.
Yeah.
That when we think of the value that wilderness has, this mythical value and its role in what it provides to us spiritually, that perhaps what we can then take is that and begin to apply it to the smaller spaces, to a national park, but as well to that forest behind us, or perhaps the edge of a creek, or again, to really see the wilderness even in our backyard.
And I think that's right. I think that's really true. I think that when you experience a particular way of being that is so inspiring, you recognize that this might actually be what life should be more like all the time. You bring a portion of that back with you and incorporate it into the way you meet the world back home. And I think that has to be a hope. That has to be a hope of what the value of a wilderness experience is, because if the only value is in going to the wilderness, then we're all going to descend on our wilderness areas, and we don't have enough of them, and they'll all be trampled. There has to be a balance in terms of our understanding of what the value of these places are, and yet that this wilderness is, in some ways, wilderness is no different than anything else. Other areas are just areas where humans, as part of nature, have shaped what has been made, and it's a very different kind of thing. But if you consider humans wild, then at some level, you can see the wilderness even in our cities and towns. And I think there's a radical form of value in that that at least is worth thinking more about.
You know what I think is really exciting about this particular conversation, and that is I feel like I've been there.
Yeah.
In the process of sharing these thoughts, I just took a journey to the wilderness sitting here in my studio in San Diego. That's pretty powerful. So at the end of all of this, then in terms of the process of the opening the book of nature, let's discuss what then happens. And then I also want people to find out how they can learn more about this. So let's do that.
Yeah. Well, so in our case, you know, we say this understanding that we've been coming to, and that you and I can talk about, and it resonates with us, and we'd like to go further with this. You know, one of the things, this is a value that probably more Americans share than we realize, but we don't usually take the time to make it explicit. And you know, even in the story of the national parks, probably this element of contemplative recreations maybe hasn't been emphasized enough, and that's why we have such a need for wilderness areas. And so we're, that next step that we're taking is to try to be explicit about some of these values and write them down. And it's been basically a process of editing We had different people that were actually taking notes on that whole trip and trying to jot down some of the insights and ideas that we were coming up with. And we've taken that material in the meantime and drafted this statement, which the hope is that it can be given to area churches in the Boundary Waters area itself. This is the kind of statement that can be passed around to make people more aware of some of the efforts that are being made to draw more attention to the spiritual value of the area. Something that might then connect people who haven't traditionally been allies of wilderness preservation might actually draw them into that work, realizing that there are some important spiritual values here that might be a resource for them in their own church or their own community. But the hope is, I think, that a statement like ours can invite more people in by communicating some of what we experienced and maybe generating some of that same kind of resonance that you and I are having here on the phone to want to get involved in this. And I think you'd have to get better details from Fred on this, but I think that's happened in many cases with some of the other statements. There was one in New Mexico on Otero Mesa that led to the local bishop writing a letter that had some political ramifications, and they had another one in North Carolina that has led to some initiatives in West Virginia now about mountaintop removal and opposing some of the mountaintop removal coal mining that's going on. And so there's sort of a ripple effect, hopefully. It's never the same, I don't think. And again, it's not something you can absolutely predict. But I think the hope is that by voicing something that is, well, back to the idea of what's theology, is something in common that we do experience, we are hoping to voice something that other people may know, but it hasn't been made explicit before. And if we can resonate with the things that others hold dear and value and cherish from within our own faith commitments, then we can maybe activate a similar, a larger community of care for creation. That, I think, is, you know, sort of what we're hoping for, is that this statement, by just being a faithful statement of the insights and the inspiration that we gain, if it can connect with other people and encourage them to delve into this some more themselves, and if we can make connections with other efforts, we can begin to reinforce one another and build a larger community for conservation based on a broader set of values that can support conservation.
Greg, for people who want to know more about the specifics, what's the best way for them to do so?
Well, the webpage for the Religious Campaign for Forest Conservation, www.creationethics.org, I think that's right. And there is a link there to the Opening the Book of Nature program, and to some of the other initiatives that have been going on similar to this. So that's one way. I think you can also find out there about some of the other wilderness statements that have been drafted from around the country. And there are also links there to other religious environmental organizations for anyone with a broad interest in how some of this is playing out. There are all manner of different resources on the World Wide Web at this point that can point or can sort of paint a picture for what other religious communities are doing and some of their success stories and those kinds of things.
We're talking with Greg Fitzhausen, who is a doctoral candidate at Cornell University. This has been a really wonderful conversation, and we'll continue in variations on this theme into the future. Greg, I want to thank you for lending your voice to the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much, Sydney. Our conversation was my pleasure.
And from the boundary waters of Minnesota, we now head down a bit to the shores of Lake Michigan, to the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
From the spiritual values of the boundary waters of northern Minnesota, we head to the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, as big as Rocky Mountain National Park, with some exciting differences. Take the plunge as the adventure continues as we explore our National Park of the Week, when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wildside News.
A great national park system is made up of an extraordinary panoply of different opportunities, from the national park, the grand parks like the Yellowstones and Rocky Mountain National Park and others. And there's a unique park up in Wisconsin that some people have heard about. And joining us now to talk about the many splendors there is Neil Hauck, who's the Assistant Chief of Interpretation and Education at the park. Neil, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, now this is a sort of mid-November, and it's in northern Wisconsin. Give people a sense of what's happening in northern Wisconsin on this day.
Right now?
Sure.
Well, it's kind of cold and gray. Most of the leaves have fallen from the trees, although I can look out my window and still see a few leaves clinging on for dear life. Hmm. But it's the fall has come and pretty much gone, and now we're on that slippery slope towards winter. We had our first snow flurries last night. I guess we're having a winter storm watch for tomorrow, so we're starting to get ready for our winter season.
Here you go, huh? I can imagine snowmobiling would be kind of a popular thing to do in your park, seashore.
Well, it's snowmobiling, but not as an end in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
What happens in the Apostle Islands, the National Lakeshore encompasses 21 of the 22 Apostle Islands here in the western end of Lake Superior. We also have a 12-mile stretch of mainland shoreline. And as we get into the winter months, the surface of the lake starts to freeze over. And by mid to late January, the ice cover gets out to the closest islands, and by February and March, the ice cover gets out through about halfway through, and in some years, all the way to the outer islands. And what's significant about that is a lot of local people like to ice fish on Lake Superior, and so they use snowmobiles and four-wheelers to cross the frozen surface of the lake to get out to the best fishing ground.
You're not crossed with a lot of designated snowmobile trails in the park, but once the lake freezes, then it becomes kind of probably an open zone.
That's right. And our park boundary goes out about a quarter of a mile from the edge of the islands.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it's just been a little over a year ago that we had special regulations enacted that that legalized the use of snowmobiles within our park boundary.
Hmm.
Primarily for safety reasons, because that's generally where quite often the ice was there and not out in the center of the channel.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to get to the fishing grounds, the fishermen would have to snug in close to the islands to get around certain areas.
Well, it's a very interesting park because it literally is composed of 21, 22 different islands. Why don't you give people kind of a visual of what makes up this park?
Well, the islands are all heavily forested, although that hasn't always been the case. You might think that being secluded on an island out in Lake Superior would have protected the forest from being cut down, but that actually, the lake made the island resources the most accessible 100, 150 years ago, before there were roads and railroads in northern Wisconsin. So the forests that were available to the lake were some of the first to fall under the axe. The white pine was particularly in demand at that time. And so most, if not all, of the islands have seen logging activity over the last 100, 150 years. But most of that activity ended more than 50 years ago. And so the forests have regenerated through a process that we like to call rewilding. Whereas in the 1930s, the area looked pretty devastated. Now, upon first look, you might think that the islands had never been logged at all. The forests are that healthy and that thick. So these are large, low islands, varying in size from 3 acres to more than 10,000 acres. And the highest of the islands goes up only about 500 feet above lake level. So they're broad, they're green, they're rather low, and they're trimmed with spectacular features like beautiful white sand beaches and fabulous red sandstone cliffs.
And then how about the land side?
The mainland unit is also quite popular, you know, for, you know, people who don't have the wherewithal to get out to the islands or don't have the time in order to do that. It's very popular for people to, you know, there are two places that you can drive into and have an opportunity to walk on the beach, visit a historic site. Commercial fishing is a story that we tell a lot in the park, and we have a commercial fishing museum at one of our mainland locations, and we also have a beautiful trail that goes along about 4 miles of the mainland shoreline and goes across the top of the cliffs where we have one of our most spectacular sea cave concentrations, and that's right on the mainland and a very popular place for people to visit, both on foot by way of the trail and by way of the lake. It's a very popular place for sea kayakers to go on calm days to see the caves and to take their boats back into the recesses and explore.
Being a lakeshore park, a national park, there's a lot of ways for people to get out and experience the diversity of nature that exists within this lake.
Being a lakeshore, one of the main reasons the area was established was because of the fabulous opportunities for waterborne recreation. And sailing has been popular in the area for many, many years. Power boating is quite popular. Over the last 20 years, the use of sea kayaks has just mushroomed in the area. And we see thousands of sea kayakers that take advantage of the protected waters between the Apostle Islands to island hop and visit some of the various locations in our park. A really popular thing for a lot of our visitors, you know, realistically, many people get here by car and may not be ready to, you know, to make the jump to the lake, or they don't have their own boat. So there is the Apostle Islands Cruise Service is the park concessioner, and they provide a variety of sightseeing cruises from May to October that give people an opportunity to go out around the islands. And they also provide a couple of trips that make stops at specific islands so people can get off to hike around, to go camping, or to visit a lighthouse. And then, you know, as we started out talking about wintertime, when the lake freezes over, you're able to walk out to an island or snowshoe or cross-country ski.
Indeed.
Or get out there on a snowmobile.
One of the things I think sounds so intriguing, the concept of hopping in a, let's say, a sea kayak and going out to the islands is really very intriguing. And from what I understand, people can do that and then camp.
Yeah, camping is available on just about all of the islands. I think we have 64, 65 campsites in the National Lakeshore right now. Almost half of all the camping that takes place in the park right now is kayak camping. You know, people coming up and loading up a sea kayak with their gear and island hopping from point to point. A lot of people come up for a real basic trip is 3 days and two nights, and that enables you to visit the inner ring of islands. More adventurous folks will take 4 or 5 days and visit some of the outermost islands. Generally, the Apostle Islands are about 2 miles apart from each other, and they vary from one, the closest is just a little over a mile offshore, the farthest is about 25 miles offshore.
That's a serious journey. Do they have to make reservations, or is it kind of first come, first serve, or how does that work?
Well, we do have a reservation system for our campsites for groups of 1 to 7 people. Right now, the way we administer it is you can call up no earlier than a month before the start of your trip. You can reserve specific sites on specific nights. So you do need to figure out an itinerary that you'd like to follow. Call up, make your reservation. Right now, the only cost there is a $15 administrative fee for camping permits. We don't charge a nightly fee, although that will be changing in 2007. So you figure out your itinerary, get your reservation for, you know, the series of sites that you want to use, and obviously if you're in a sea kayak, you are dependent on the weather, wind, and wave conditions. We have a saying that we use up here, it's the lake is the boss. When the wind comes up and the waves get big, you just don't go out. And we take that into consideration with folks who plan their trip. We just ask them to make their best guess on, you know, where they would like to be, and then if they get stuck somewhere windbound, somewhere along their itinerary, generally, if the conditions are bad enough that you can't leave your campsite, they're also bad enough that no one's going to get to your campsite. So everybody's trip gets changed.
You also have an interesting feature there, and that is the black bear, and you have some legendary numbers. Tell me, first of all, for people who are heading off kayaking on some of these islands, you know, black bears are something you definitely have to take into consideration. Are they on the islands themselves, the black bear?
Right. It's not necessarily intuitive to think that bears are on the islands. You know, most people are familiar with the fact that there are bears in Wisconsin, but they think that by going out to the islands, they would be avoiding running into the bears, and that's not necessarily the case. The largest island in the National Lakeshore is Stockton Island. It has a little bit more than 10,000 acres, and it's home to one of the densest black bear populations in the United States. There may be as many as 30 to 40 bears living on Stockton Island at any one time. In recent years, the numbers have been closer to 20 or 25, but that's still a significant number of bears for an island that size. And so we go through a very careful process with helping the people plan their trips so that they're, A, familiar with the fact that they'll be finding bears out on the island, and B, what they need to do to properly store their food so that they don't encourage bears to come into the campsite.
What do you tell people to do?
Well, for islands like Stockton Island, we provide bear-proof food storage lockers at each of the campsites.
That helps.
Large metal boxes that clip closed so that the bears can't get into the food. Some of our more remote islands don't have the food lockers, so we do advise people of the need to take along rope and stuff sacks so that they can hang their food up in the trees away from the campsites. To help train the bears to avoid the campsites, you know, we ask people that if they see a bear within 50 yards of a campsite, to make lots of noise, appear as large as possible, yell at the bear, do what they can to let the bear know it's not welcome in the area. When people encounter bears out on the trails away from the campsites and other visitor use areas like docks and picnic areas, then we ask them to respect the fact that they're in bear territory and to just slowly, quietly back away, leave the bear alone, and let it go on about its business. Trying to get the word across, or give the impression to the bears that there are certain areas that they're not welcome in at certain times, whereas other areas they're free to be in and just be bears.
We're talking with Neil Houck, who is the Assistant Chief of Interpretation and Education for the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore Park up in northern Wisconsin. What's your nearest big town?
Well, the closest large town is, it's the Twin Ports of Duluth, Minnesota, and Superior, Wisconsin, at the extreme western end of Lake Superior. It's about 90 miles west of our location.
Mm-hmm. A rather interesting aspect of the park that certainly fascinates a lot of people, and that is the lighthouses. You have quite a record collection there.
Yes, that's right. We have light stations on six of the islands in the National Lakeshore. And depending on how you count the towers, we have at least eight of those. We have more lights than any other unit of the National Park System. All six of the light stations are included in the National Register of Historic Places, and they are our responsibility to care for them and maintain them.
They're open to the public.
We try to keep a number of them open to the public during the summer months. We generally have a uniform ranger interpreter at our Raspberry Island Lighthouse. That's the one that's easiest to get to, and it's the most heavily visited lighthouse. Usually from 5 to 10,000 people a year will get a tour of that lighthouse. And then we usually also have lights at Sand Island, Devil's Island, and Michigan Island, also staffed by park volunteers, so we can make those available for the public to visit from June into September.
Well, now, Neil, from what I understand, you've been at the Apostle Islands for about 20 years. That's a lot of time to spend in one national park. In that time, one really gets to know the place. Kind of on a personal level, go ahead and tell us what you find that really speaks to you as an interpreter and a human.
We did a visitor study about a year ago to learn more about the people who are coming to the Apostle Islands. And one of the things, you know, that we asked people, you know, is what sorts of things that they did when they come here. And, you know, the top responses were sightseeing and walking on the beach. I guess I have to put myself in a category with most everybody else. You know, walking on a beach is one of my favorite things to do up here. And, you know, we've got beaches on the mainland and on most of the islands that are spectacular. One of my favorites is the Julian Bay Beach out on Stockton Island. It's about a mile and a third long. It's a beautiful white sand beach, and it's remarkable for its singing sand, sand that squeaks when you walk on it. And it's, you know, every time I get to Stockton Island, I make a point of getting over to Julian Bay, walking on the beach, snorkeling out to a wreck site that's only a couple hundred yards offshore. It's just a great place to visit. Probably another one of my favorite places is, I think I mentioned some of the sea caves that we have along the shoreline here. Probably the most accessible sea caves are near our mainland unit. These are, it's a line of cliffs made out of reddish sandstone that's more than a billion years old. And the very thinly bedded sandstone gets eroded into spectacular features by the wave action that pounds the cliffs. And you can walk along the top of the cliffs and look down at the caves. I like to pick calm days in the summertime, take my canoe out to the sea caves and just sit inside the caves and be rocked around by the, you know, the gentle waves and listen to the sounds of the lake gurgling back into the deepest recesses of the cracks and fissures in the rock. And I love going out there in the wintertime once it all freezes up and you've got a tremendous, beautiful reddish sandstone bordered by the crystal white ice and snow and blue sky up above. It's just an amazing scene. And when we do get ice to walk on, you know, we get several thousand visitors in the months of February and March taking advantage of the opportunity to get out there at that unique time of the year.
Since it's winter is coming and ice fishing is such a popular sport, when can people get out there and do that, and what kind of fish are they going to catch?
Starting in about a month, the ice will be forming up in the shallowest portions of the bay, just off of the Bayfield Peninsula. It usually doesn't get out to the area around the Apostle Islands until about mid-January. Usually by late January, early February, the inner group of islands is usually the channels in between those islands get ice covered with enough ice, 6, 8, 12 inches of ice, that the ice fishermen will be heading out there. And usually what the ice fishermen are after are the lake trout. They'll take their ice augers out and go bobbing for lake trout in the waters off of the islands.
When people want to find out more about the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, what's the best way to do so?
You can check our parks website. It's part of the National Park Service website, which is www.nps.gov/APIS. And that'll take you to our parks homepage with links to a lot of specific information about camping, campgrounds, procedures to get camping permits, lots of information about our lighthouses. We have excerpts from the old logbooks, stories of the lighthouse keepers on our website, which are a lot of fun to read. Calling the park, we're happy to answer questions. Our phone number is 715-779-3397. From 8 to 4:30 most days. There's folks here in the office that will be happy to answer questions, and we'll, you know, be glad to send responses to mail requests for information as well.
Well, Neil Houck, Assistant Chief of Interpretation and Education at the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, I want to thank you for sharing the information about your park and lending your voice to the Wild Side News.
Glad to do it. Always happy to talk about the Apostle Islands.
It's my impression that Americans are rewilding their spirit, revaluing their lands, and reawakening to a vision of a united people who truly cherish life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The signs of change are subtle, but showing up. Let's keep this momentum going. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again next week or anytime on the archives when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News.